Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing education and training for all UK-registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and a final examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. When I first qualified, myopia was something that we just accepted as a refractive status that we corrected with spectacles or contact lenses. And yes, we knew that highly myopic eyes were more at risk than others, but apart from that, our management was fairly passive. Since then, our understanding of myopia has grown and is still increasing. We now have the opportunity as optometrists to play an active role in myopia management, potentially reducing the extent of myopic progression.
We are in a position now where the prediction suggests 50% of the population is going to be myopic by the middle of this century. So that's a huge headline.
I spoke to Professor Ed Mallon, Head of School of Optometry and Vision Science at Bradford University. He spoke of the growing myopia epidemic, which sounds dramatic and justifiably so. By 2050, approximately 10% of the world's population will have high myopia, which is potentially pathological myopia, and that will be nearly 1 billion people. There are likely to be several contributing factors. Research has shown that children who spend more time outdoors are less likely to become highly myopic. The mechanism of this is unclear and could be related to either extended periods of close work or light exposure or a combination of both factors. Myopia is a big concern. Uncorrected, it is the most common cause of avoidable distance visual impairment. And myopic macular degeneration has already become the leading cause of uncorrectable vision loss in some parts of the world, which is why, as a profession, we can have such an important role to play.
I was really fortunate to do my PhD with Bernard Gilmartin at Aston University. And the things that are being said now, Bernard was saying those things 30 years ago around the vulnerability of the myopic eye and all of those measurements that we perhaps should be making. And it is wonderful to see so much research going on across the world to try and address this problem. But it's not always been a really hot topic, but it certainly is now.
And I think what's so important is that every optometrist in practice has the opportunity to do something about it, to try and prevent this epidemic. Because instead of just seeing myopia and correcting those prescriptions so that patients can carry on with their lives and see well, they can actually intervene and hopefully prevent some of the myopia from progressing, can't they?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the correction aspect of myopia is obviously a huge thing. But you're right that we are now in a position to be able to think a little bit more about how we can control the level of myopia that someone ends up at the end of their journey through myopia progression. We're now getting to a position where it's a much more active process, and it's wonderful to see new products and new techniques available for managing myopia with a view to slowing down the progression of the myopic eye, which will limit the level of the final prescription. An example would be if we can identify a child that we think, because of their refractive error, their ocular biometry and their lifestyle, means that they're going to become a -7 or -8 myope. If we can intervene and then that child ends up as -3 or -4 instead of -7 or -8, that's a brilliant story of success, actually. That's fabulous. But what would be really good is if we can look at a child before they're myopic and look at their family history, look at their biometry and all of those other factors and say, right, you're going to be a myope. Let's intervene and let's prevent you becoming myopic at all. That would be, if you like, a prophylactic approach to myopia management.
Yeah, that would be the ultimate win. Myopia management with soft contact lenses is now available for optometrists to prescribe and fit patients with. But for many of us, it's still a new process. Unlike Ortho-K, myopia control soft lenses do not require any specific training in complex contact lens fitting and can be fitted just like a normal soft multifocal contact lens. Design-wise, the concept is similar to a centre distance multifocal lens, with a central portion providing clear distance acuity, while the peripheral zones are focused light in front of the retina. This removes the stimulus for axial length growth, which in turn will slow down the progression of myopia. To gain an insight into the patient experience, our producer Dr. Hilary Geit spoke to one parent, Elizabeth Nutter, and her daughter Elodie, who is 9 years old. Hilary started by asking Elizabeth about the decision to start her daughter using MySight lenses.
I'm short-sighted, I'm minus 5, but my husband is short-sighted and he's minus 10, and every time he goes to the optician, he's getting more short-sighted. So for us, our concern is that our children will be very short-sighted. The disadvantages of the programme were far outweighed by the advantage that my daughter's short-sightedness may not progress as dramatically if we didn't do it. Obviously, we were worried about the contact lens, putting them in, taking them out, but my daughter is fastidious about washing her hands, so I knew that she would always wash her hands before she did it. And also, I wear contact lenses every day, so she has grown up watching me take them in, put them out. So it's normal for her, and she knows that I don't ever touch my eyes. So I feel like we'd almost trained her up for it, so it seemed the perfect solution, really.
Elodie, can I ask you some questions now?
Yeah, sure.
How did you find wearing the contact lenses at first?
I found putting them in quite hard. I never had any troubles taking out, but putting them in I struggled with at the start, but now I'm okay with putting them in.
Were you worried about anything to begin with?
I wasn't really worried about anything because my mum wears contact lenses, so I've always grown up watching my mum put them in, so I wasn't really worried about anything.
And do you like wearing contact lenses?
Yeah, I like wearing them because I can do things like horse riding and gymnastics, which I like doing, and I don't have to worry about breaking my glasses.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'll ask Mum a few more questions now. So she has to wear them how often? Is it every day?
So she has to wear them 6 days a week, and so that's generally what she does. So she wears them for school every day, because she's in quite a routine with that. She brushes her teeth, puts her lenses in, goes to school, and it's just part of the routine. But sometimes, usually on a Sunday, she tends to not bother, just to give her a break, really.
So it just works easily within you're not having to sort of be on her case all the time and remind her. And
no, she's really taken to it. She's really independent with it. It's not a problem at all. I'm really pleased with how it's worked, actually. But I did think that she would take to it very well.
Why did you think that?
I think just because there was no fear with wearing them because it was so normal to her. And she's quite organised, really. So if she's got a routine, she follows her routine.
So she's been wearing the contact lenses for a year. What have the results been so far, other than lots of horse riding and gymnastics?
Well, so far, it's just stayed the same as her eyes, so that's good. And she's actually having another test soon, so we'll see again. But yes, it's not got any worse, which is obviously great.
So you're really pleased?
Yes.
Fantastic. Elizabeth Nutter, thank you very much, and thank you to Elodie.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And that's where we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover or have a fascinating case you want to share, email us podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. I'm now joined by Catherine Webber, optometrist and manager of the Myopia Management Clinic at Bradford University. Catherine, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
You're very welcome.
So how myopic was Elodie when you started myopia management? Had her myopia been creeping up?
Elodie was not hugely myopic when we started the treatment. She was about minus 0.75 in her worse eye. We started treatment with her quite early because her parents had done some research previously for their elder son about myopia management. So as soon as Elodie started becoming a little bit myopic, they were ready to come in and see us.
I see. And I think myopia management as a concept is quite a new field for many optometrists. And I think I'd really like to break it down in this podcast into some quite digestible components so that if an optometrist is listening to this and think, yes, I really do want to get involved, that they know where to start. So to begin with, how do you go about identifying who is a suitable candidate?
So the things to look for, we know genetics is a big factor.
Yeah.
So if you've got one parent who's myopic, that triples your risk of being myopic. And if you've got two parents who are myopic, then that doubles the risk again. So, yeah, if you're testing the eyes of a myope and you're chatting to them and you find out they've got young children, it's worth kind of having a conversation about myopia. Most people don't know about myopia management, and not parents are actually really interested once they realise it's an option. So, yeah, have the conversation. Look at children's prescriptions. So when you're testing kids, think about kind of age match norms. So how hyperopic would we expect this child to be?
Mm.
So a rule of thumb, if you've got a child who's sort of 6 or 7, they should be at least plus 050. So if they're any less than that, they're potentially kind of on the road to myopia. Or equally, if they're losing their kind of normal hyperopia at a faster rate, so if they're kind of losing hyperopia by half a diopter a year or more, that can be a sign that they're heading towards being myopic.
Okay, so you've had the conversation with a parent, and I think it's quite a good idea because quite often parents do feel that they've had the vision checked at school, perhaps with the vision screening. So sometimes they don't bother with an eye examination. So it does emphasise the importance of actually having a proper full eye examination, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, often parents will assume that if their children aren't complaining, then their vision must be fine. So I think it's really important to get them into their regular sight tests, and you can start monitoring their prescription.
So bearing in mind that the best outcome for myopia management is a reduction or a slowing down of myopic progression, it's actually quite hard to demonstrate and prove that actually the myopia has been successful. So how do you go about explaining this to parents and setting their expectations at the right level?
Yeah, so communication is a massive part of the myopia management clinic. It's probably the thing that I actually spend more time doing than any of the tests or anything else, talking to the parents and the children. Setting their expectations is really important. So they often turn up assuming that we can stop the myopia or even get rid of some myopia that's already there. So it's really important that we kind of are open about what we can expect to achieve. Open about the fact that the research can kind of tell us on average how much we can slow the progression down, but nothing about individuals. And also I think the kind of fact that we're never going to know what the outcome would have been if we hadn't intervened. So again, we're kind of talking averages about, on average, this will slow it by 50%. We don't know how much it'll slow it down in your child. And even once we get to the end of the myopia treatment, we're not going to know how much we've slowed it down by. So I think that's really important to kind of be really open about that initially. And open about what we do and what we don't know. So, you know, there are still holes in the areas of research. So nearly all the research is done on 8 to 12-year-olds who are kind of less than 4 diopters myopic. That's not always who we treat. We treat people who are more myopic than that, or younger children or older children. So we need to sort of be really open and honest about what we do know and what we don't know.
Is fitting a myopia control lens such as the MiSight more difficult than a normal soft lens, or is it just the progressive element that you need to be a little bit more careful with?
It's no different from fitting a normal soft lens. There are certain things that you sort of need to look for carefully, so all the movement of the lens and everything as normal. Centration is really important. So if the lens isn't well centred, you'll find that the child probably struggles with their vision and we won't be getting the full effect of the lens. The lenses do have an adaptation period, so you'll often find that children will complain of halos around lights and sort of their vision being not quite perfectly clear initially. That usually goes after the first couple of weeks. It doesn't usually hang about too long, but it's worth knowing that. I often find we have to slightly give a little bit of an over-refraction as well, maybe a minus 025 or a minus 050 to get their VA up. But obviously it's important not to over minus too much, because you're then reducing the effect of the kind of plus power that we've got in the lens that's doing the job.
Do you cycloplege all your patients before fitting them?
Yes. Yeah, I do. So when they come in for their initial appointment, so the first time we meet them, we do a full cycloplegic refraction. So we want to be really sure about the prescription that we've got. Good look, obviously, at the front and the back of the eye through the dilated pupil, make sure that they're really healthy. Full BV workup. Like we say, the BV does have an impact.
So in practice, if someone wanted to start fitting these lenses, they don't have access to any way of measuring axial length normally. So is that piece of data essential for fitting these lenses?
It's not essential. It is nice to have it. I mean, it's very useful data because obviously that's what the research looks at as the outcome measures. But you can fit the lenses just as normal soft lenses, and you could look at the outcome as in how much they're progressing. That is a little bit tricky because obviously progression tends to slow with time anyhow. So kind of if you're comparing against past progression, it's probably not the best thing to look at, but there are tables as to how much we would expect children to progress in the myopia at each age. So you can compare against the kind of normal values to see whether you think it's having an impact. But axial length is an interesting thing to have, and interesting from the point of view of even for adults, you might have a minus two myope who's got, you know, 27 millimetre long eyes, who are at more risk than a minus six with a 25 millimetre eye. So it's it'd be an interesting topic for future, but no, wouldn't mean you couldn't fit them.
It's not essential.
No.
Okay. So supposing that an optometrist has fitted a patient with these lenses, what's the typical follow-up schedule? How often do you need to see them? And is there any difference in the way you assess those contact lens wearers?
No significant difference, I would say. So I tend to see the patients after 2 weeks to see how they're getting on. I think it's really important to make sure they can contact you within those 2 weeks, because that tends to be the time that if they're going to have problems either with inserting the lenses or the vision, it's important they can get in contact with you, that when they can be put off. Check the over-refraction, check the fit, all the usual stuff that you would do in an aftercare. And from then, generally, I'd see them at 3 months. Again, just to make sure they're getting on okay, you know, make sure they're not having any problems, there's no issues. And then I'd go to 6 monthly checkups from then. And once a year, they'd have their kind of full, so the same as the initial fit visit, so their cyclorefraction and ophthalmoscopy and everything else.
So really, it's just making sure that you have all the right resource at the very beginning, isn't it? It's making sure that you have the information at hand about the lenses so that you know how to communicate that to the patient and reassure them. And also you mentioned about knowing about typical progression and if a child appears to be losing their hypermetropia more rapidly. Is there any reference source that optometrists can go to look at that information?
A lot of the manufacturers produce a lot of good information. So obviously CooperVision make the MySight lenses. Johnson & Johnson getting into myopia management. So they've recently published a kind of booklet about myopia management with a lot of the age match norms in. The Brian Holden Institute, which is an Australian research institute, but they do a lot of work on myopia. They have a really good myopia calculator, which I often use to show parents. So you can put in how myopic the child is at the minute and their age, and it kind of plots how myopic they probably will be. So that's a really nice visual tool that you can kind of sit with the parents and say, look, you know, this is what we're looking at doing.
Thank you. That's really useful. I'll add that to the learning resources on the learning management system on our website. So I think the benefits of not being a high myope are really obvious to anyone listening to this. But there are longer term health benefits as well for not being highly myopic, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And that's why we're interested in doing this. So it's become more and more obvious over the last few years that the risks of being myopic in later life are quite significant. So retinal detachment is the one we all worry about and think about, you know, myopes and retinal detachment. And, you know, if you're minus six or over, you've got a kind of 20 times risk of retinal detachment over someone who's plano. So it's certainly significant. Myopic maculopathy is probably even bigger risk. And that you've got 40 times increased risk by the time you're minus six or above. Glaucoma as well, 5 times greater risk of glaucoma once you're over minus six. And it's not just the high myopes. So it's not just, you know, you're fine until you get to minus six and suddenly you're at risk. Each diopter increases your risk. So even what we would think of, you know, fairly moderate levels of myopia, so minus three-ish, you're still getting a kind of 9 times higher risk of myopic maculopathy and retinal detachment. So the earlier we can intervene, slow the progression down, the more of an impact we're going to have in the long term.
Yes, because it's actually trying to limit the axial length growth as the child's developing, isn't it? So it is a case of catching it early as possible. So if there was a final message that you had to give to the optometrists that are out there listening who want to get involved, what message or what advice would that be?
I think look for the patients early. That's the really key thing, because if you can start having these conversations with parents a couple of years before the children need the intervention, by the time they do need it, they're kind of prepared and they've asked all the questions and they're ready to go. So the earlier we start this, the better. The fastest progression is within the first couple of years. So do something rather than nothing, I think, is the key message. Whether it is just having that conversation and referring the patient on to someone else if you don't want to do it yourself, or use what you've got. So MySight lenses, widely available now. There are spectacle lenses that are going to become more widely available. There's Ortho-K. You might not have all of these things, but you'll probably have access to at least one of them.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. If you would like more information about myopia management, go to our website, docket.info, and search for Sound Optometry to find the additional reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website will gain one CET point covering communication, standards of practice, and contact lenses. Next time, we'll be discussing tumours of the ocular surface and tumours of the anterior chamber with Professor Heinrich Hyman. We'd really appreciate it if you spread the word about the podcast, tell your colleagues to listen, or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. The producers are Dr. Hilary Guite and Jason Hosking. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.